are joined by Mr. Ashok Swain, Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at the Uppsala University in Sweden. Professor Swain, so glad to have you here on the program. First of all, we want to know if this crisis, the tens of thousands of Afghans who are scrambling to flee the country, could this have been avoided in the first place?
Yes, I think in one sense, probably the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan could have been managed better. But to be honest, any sort of troop withdrawals after a defeat or accepting a defeat is always messy, and it became messier because the fall of the Afghan government in a very quick time. So it surprised everyone. It could have been possibly, if they would have imagined before, they could have taken some kind of measures which probably would have been a bit more orderly, but at present, I think it was also somehow a little bit inevitable what we are witnessing now.
Professor, the new mass exodus of Afghans is now fast snowballing into a major humanitarian crisis. Would you hold the foreign powers who led the 20-year failed war in the country responsible for the chaos?
Yes, of course, because as you know, Afghanistan is going through a violent conflict of some sort for the more than four decades now. But at least for the last two decades, when the international community, particularly after overthrowing Taliban regime in 2001, it promised that it is going to build Afghanistan, all these kind of more than $2.3 trillion were in the name of Afghanistan were spent, 20 years were kept Afghanistan under a puppet government. But what had happened in Afghanistan? We saw the poverty doubled. The poverty, people living under poverty has doubled. At present, one third of Afghan population need food assistance because they are suffering from food scarcity. Half of the Afghan people do not have drinking water. Two third of Afghans don't have electricity. So what we have done in the last 20 years in the international community being involved and with the huge amount, number of loss of life, both by in Afghanistan and outside, huge amount of money spent, but what has happened? Nothing.
Now let's pause the questions and take a look at how the global media has covered the new Afghan refugee crisis sparked by the shocking turn of events in recent weeks.
For the Afghan people, what the Biden administration has done is make things even worse. The chaotic scene at Kabul's international airport proves that the remaining US troops are not in the least prepared to control the situation in Afghanistan after their withdrawal. In the end, US military forces will take thousands of Afghan people to the US through the so-called special immigrant visas program for Afghans. But the refugee problem of Afghanistan will bring endless troubles to its neighboring countries. The current wave of Afghan refugees should also be seen within the context of the earlier waves who tried to escape conflict, persecution, and violence in their country. Population movement out of Afghanistan has been a consistent phenomenon of its history over the past 40 years. Yet many fleeing today are the ones who returned to Afghanistan post-2001, having trusted the international community and its commitment towards Afghans and Afghanistan. They, unlike their predecessors, feel betrayed. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, says that as many as 500,000 people are ready to flee Afghanistan in the coming months in a worst-case scenario. According to the UN agency, there are already around 2.2 million Afghans who are registered as refugees abroad, the vast majority of them in neighboring Iran and Pakistan. But the actual numbers of Afghans in both countries is likely much, much higher when undocumented Afghans are included.
Several European countries have continued to deport Afghan refugees over the years, and again, they are cold-shouldering refugees and migrants from Afghanistan. What's your take on this act of negligence?
Yeah, it's a sort of double standard has been maintained. Of course, you know, there have been some countries in Europe, they have taken more refugees than others, and refugee issue has, particularly Germany and Sweden, but the refugee issue have divided almost or will collapse the European Union unity 5 years back when the Syrian crisis was taking place. But in the last 2 years, there are more Afghan refugees coming to Europe than from Syria. So the number has increased for a long period of time. But still, they were trying to push Afghan refugees back to their country. There have been a huge politics is going on in the Europe with the rise of populist nationalism. This is becoming more and more issue. And I think they don't understand that the large number of Afghan refugees live in the neighboring country rather than coming anywhere.
And what about Iran and Pakistan? They already host around 90% of Afghan refugees. Now that more are coming, especially those turned away by the West, why don't we hear anything about it in the Western media?
As I said, if you look at the refugee number, most of the refugees live in the developing countries or next to their conflict, where the conflict takes place. But those refugees never come to the media attention, and there is a small number which comes to the West, makes such a huge news because of this. But there has been, it's a huge politicization taking place. Media gets very highly engaged, and those kind of issues needs to be seriously reflected upon. Needs to look at, as you mentioned, Afghanistan refugees for the last, for 40 years, have been living quite close to both in Iran as well as in Pakistan, and all 90% of it. But other countries have very, very small number of refugees living. These countries, those who claim to have a moral authority and power, and also really creating this kind of conflict-led disaster, which really leading to these refugee issues, but are not accepting refugees.
The post 9/11 wars by the US have displaced at least 38 million people in countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Pakistan. Now, Professor, do you believe the U.S. owes reparations to these war-stricken people?
I think this is, as I said, the countries have, those who have been engaged in the war in other parts of the world, do not take the responsibility, the kind of humanitarian disaster, the humanitarian crisis they bring to these countries. There have been huge humanitarian catastrophe have been due to of these regions, but of course there is no such thing at place to take actions against those who are committing these kind of atrocities against the people. And I think this is absolutely we international community is failing in that sense, that or stopping these kind of things repeating itself.
There you have it, Professor Swain from the Uppsala University in Sweden. Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, Professor. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on Afghanistan's refugee crisis that is snowballing into a major humanitarian catastrophe.
Ahmad Shah Katawazai, an Afghan-American diplomat, blames the refugee crisis in Afghanistan on the international community apart from the Afghan political leadership. US-based Muslim preacher and author Omar Suleiman appeals for help to Afghan refugees, says they have for years been bombed, abandoned, and betrayed. American journalist Steph Kite, pointing to the worsening refugee crisis, says many countries are preemptively shutting their doors to Afghan refugees. Bruno Miquez, a Portuguese politician and author, paints a vivid picture of situation in Kabul, with desperate Afghans seeking evacuation amid rocket and drone attacks. Former Afghan government official Zara Akbari says no one wants to abandon home, and Afghans simply demand evacuation of refugees the United States created.
And that was our episode on Afghanistan's new refugee crisis engineered by the US and its allies, and also the reckless response of Western countries to this major humanitarian crisis. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Who is fighting Imam al-Hussein? Who is at war with Imam al-Hujjah? I don't want to go over concepts that are not practical, because that doesn't tell us what we're signing up for. That is, again, going to be something that's at least not clear. We want to be very practical, very contemporary. Anyone who takes any measure against Islam is fighting the manifestation of Islam, Imam al-Hujjah and Imam al-Hussein. Anyone who fights Islam, anyone who takes any measure against Islam, Amir al-Mu'mineen considered anyone who fought the Muslims, who was trying to create, impose a threat for the Muslimin from the outside, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, these were the ones that were there. Amir al-Mu'mineen considered them the enemies of Islam. Therefore, them creating and posing a threat for Muslimin. Ali ibn Abi Talib is in Medina. Ali ibn Abi Talib instructs people, including the second Khalifa, who was the accepted ruler at the time. He tells them, this is how you need to do it. Anyone who attacks Muslimin. Okay. Let's look at this, brothers and sisters. Let's look at the conditions that we have. Let's look at the Muslimin. Let's look at Islam. Western rulers have been fighting, besides others, Islam and the Muslimin for, in the recent history, the time that they started making progress and conquest of Muslim lands. In the last 150, close to 200 years, they started going towards Muslim lands. They've been fighting. The British have fought the Muslimin, are fighting the Muslimin. The Portuguese fought Islam and the Muslimin. The Dutch fought Islam and the Muslimin. The French fought Islam and the Muslimin. The Germans did that. Any European power that you see today, all these countries, the ones that are powerful, they have all been fighting Islam at a time where the U.S. was just developing. And then post-Second World War, again, amongst others, the United States government has been fighting Islam and Muslims on various different levels. Part of it is military combat, military conflict with Muslimin. We may disagree with Muslimin on certain levels and certain beliefs or whatever, But as the Prophet said, anyone from the outside of the Muslimin that attacks any Muslim and calls Ya lal Muslimin, it is the responsibility of the others to respond. And in other words, the one who is involved with aggression with Muslimin of whatever sect and whatever belief they are fighting Islam, and they are fighting Imam al-Hujjah, there's been numerous, they conquered all Muslim lands. Let's not forget that. From the Far East, the Philippines were Muslim lands. Malaysia, Indonesia, Muslim lands. India, Muslim land. Bangladesh, Muslim lands. Much of that area is Muslim lands. They conquered all of that. Afghanistan, Central Asia, Uzbek, all these different lands, one way or another, whether the Eastern Europeans, Western Europeans, Iran, Iraq, Arabia, Northern Africa, various African countries, East Africa with such a large Muslim population, all conquered. There's war. That is, these are those who are harb with Islam, and they are harb with the Imam of our time. When you say, إِنِّي حَرْبٌ لِمَنْ حَارَبَكُمْ, you're saying, I'm at war with these people. Is this something of the past? No, because it's not only military conflict. Western powers have been depicting, giving the image that reflects their image. They're giving that to Islam. All the deaths that they have created in the past couple of centuries, the slavery that they have created, every wrong thing that they know and they reflect and is their image, they're saying Islam is that. This is a type of war. The reason why an average Westerner would feel bad about seeing a Muslim, seeing a hijabi, an ignorant American would even go so far as using foul language, physically harassing a Muslimah. They're ignorant. The ones who are causing this ignorant person to think that way are the elite in the West. They've been fighting Islam in that way. Economic wars, ideological war, which is the essence of a political war. This is who they are. This is what harb liman harab. These are the ones that are doing harb of the Imam of our time. If you want to sign up for Inni Salmu liman salamakum, if you want to say that in Ziyarat Ashura, you're referring to Abu Abdullah. You address him. You got to see him before you. Ya Abu Abdullah, inni silmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. Harbun liman harabakum means these people who are fighting Islam, I am going to fight back. If you don't want to, don't sign up for it. Don't say that. From the beginning, don't say it. Don't say, yeah, I do my... These clothes, this amama is for the battlefield, the ideological battlefield. And it's our kefen. That's what it is. It's prepared. Any point. This is what we sign up for. In Nisilman, we say it. Ask Imam al-Hussein if at any point, Ya Abu Abdullah, at any point, it gets to a point where you see, I may abandon you, abandon my post, not fight your enemies, abandon you in that battlefield. Ya Abu Abdullah, take this life. It's not worth living. If it's for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, if it's for Imam al-Hujjah, alhamdulillah, ahla min al-asal. It's the best thing. I don't want this. We don't want this. These are the words of anyone who signs up for Inni silmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum. If any European country decides to tell the Muslimin in that country, you are not allowed to show loyalty to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein by not being able to support the ones who put their lives down for Imam al-Hussein, who shed their blood for Imam al-Hussein, who were killed by the enemies of the Imam in Baghdad, Shaheed Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Shaheed Haj Qasim Sulaiman. If any European country decides to put that law, that's fighting Islam, that's harb against Islam. You are saying, harbul liman harabakum, I will fight back.
Ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein, ya Habib, ya Hussein, ya Habib.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you're listening to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today, we will deal with a question that is often posed to the Shia Muslim believers of Islam. And the question is as follows. Isn't 1,400 years of repetitive crying and mourning for the tragedy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam not enough? The question is, do we not tire of crying for the Imam? What do you say, dear Sheikh? Do we tire from crying for the Imam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course not. There are a couple of points that we need to take into consideration. First of all, when it comes to mourning and crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, We need to pay attention to at least two aspects. One of them is emotion, and the other is the philosophy beyond mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. For the part of emotion, yes, some people say that it's 14 centuries, about 13, 14 centuries have passed from the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, but still you are crying. But it's a matter of people crying for their emotions. Let me give you one example. So let's say, for example, a father passes away. So his children might cry for him a couple of weeks. And each year, maybe even for some decades, each year on the anniversary of his demise, they will remember him and they cry. And it's very normal, and it's very logical. Now imagine that their father doesn't die a natural death, rather he's brutally killed. So in the second case, for sure his family members will cry for him more.
There's a difference between passing while sleeping at night very peacefully in bed and being not just murdered, but brutally murdered.
Brutally murdered. So when you remember how brutally your dear father was killed, from time to time you may remember him and cry for him, and nobody will call you, an insane person. Why do you cry for your father?
You're too sensitive.
Too sensitive.
No one would say that.
Yeah. And not only the children, then the next generation, when the grandchildren, they remember how their grandfather was brutally killed, they will also cry for him too. Let's add to that, not only your father, your brothers are also brutally killed. Not only your brothers, your nephews and some of the close relatives. So for sure, in that case, many generations may come and cry for their forefathers and family members, who were many in number, and all of them, within a couple of hours, they were brutally killed. So I think even in the most secular societies, away from religious issues, if it happens for them, for some decades maybe, they will mourn, and at least whenever they remember those incidents, they will cry for them, and at least on the anniversaries of such an event.
They'll remember them, but also, as you said, even in the most secular society, they also, for example, they have movies in the theaters, or they read books who are sad books, like drama movies or sad tragedies, and they cry for something that is fake, not real, and done by actors.
Yeah.
But we do not come and say, oh, you're crazy for crying because of this scene in this movie. This no, because it is a human fake. Emotion, even if it's fake.
Yeah.
But this is very much real.
And the next point which adds to it is that now imagine your father, your brothers, and your nephews, and the other family members who were brutally killed were the most righteous human beings on the earth.
It just gets worse and worse as soon as you, of course.
Yeah, so it's another aspect. It's much different from, when your father, for example, was not a very good man and he was brutally killed, so you may cry for him for some time, but that, imagine, we are talking about the most righteous human beings on the earth. We are talking about an imam. We are talking about
best
Abu
Dhabi.
The best
creation.
People, yeah. So I would want to put emphasis on the fact that, we are not apologetic for that. Crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is related to our emotion too. Although 13, 14 centuries have passed, but 72 people who were the best human beings on the earth were brutally martyred by the most wicked people, and then the family members, imagine that, sometimes your father is brutally killed, but your mother is highly respected by others, your sisters, your brothers, but on the plain of Karbala, on the tragedy of Karbala, right after killing Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the women, the kids are going to, they are somehow captured, arrested.
They were treated as slaves.
Slaves.
And this is the household of the Prophet.
That's
the Prophet of Islam, who made this Islamic community, this ummah. So it's not just a random family living in the desert.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam is of course a matter of emotion. We are not apologetic for that. We remember our Imam, we remember his brother Abul Fadl Abbas, his children, his nephews, his great companions, and the fact that we remember Lady Zainab salamullah alayha, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and all those kids and women who were went into captivity, I mean with a very humiliating method. They were taken into different cities. So for sure, it's a matter of emotion, and we cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam because of the fact that I gave you some examples that it's very normal that if it happens in any other community, they will cry for them for centuries.
It's
and
a natural reaction.
Exactly. So this is the first point. The second point is that there are some philosophies for crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So one side is that it's related to emotion, but the second point is that when we talk about crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we have narrations in both Shia and Sunni narrations about the significance of crying. Of course, I will talk about the philosophy, but first of all, we need to know that the narrations of the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, the prophetic narrations in both Shia and Sunni narrations and the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt in Shia collection of hadith, they tell about the significance of crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Maybe it might be interesting to know about one such narration in Sunni sources. Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the great Sunni scholar, in the book Fada'il al-Sahaba, volume 2, page 675, he says that crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and all the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam has the reward of Jannah, paradise. And we know that there are many narrations about the importance of crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, even if it is only one drop of crying. And according to one narration, Imam al-Rida alayhi salam says that if you want to cry anything, then cry for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And not only crying, crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is so important that we have the concept of tabaki in the narrations. And exactly. Tabaki means that you're not able to cry to somehow pretend that you are...
Lower your head out of respect.
Yeah,
of course.
It's a kind of respect for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So from this perspective, we have such narrations in our books which are telling us about the importance of crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and we are doing that every year. And the next point is about philosophy of crying. Is it only about emotions? No, it's not only about emotions. If it was only about emotions, I believe that we did not have all these narrations, such number of the narrations about the importance of even tabaki for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So these narrations give us a message that it is beyond emotions. It is about remembering Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the reason that he had his uprising.
Right.
Crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam is crying for, oppression and justice.
Exactly.
The fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred for the sake of preserving justice and for removing oppression and injustice from the Islamic society. So, we do not believe that it is only the matter of emotions. No, it's about emotion, and it's also about thinking about the philosophy of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I believe if we did not have these narrations about the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the importance of crying for him, gradually people would forget about Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the reasons that he had his uprising,
which is perhaps more important. It is his uprising. That's the philosophy of
exactly.
It. We cry because of what he stood for.
Exactly. And we see that in the history of Islam, and especially the Shia school of thought, almost in all the cases that there was a kind of uprising by the justice-seeking people against the oppressive people. It was, they were inspired by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And nowadays we need to see that back in 1979, the Islamic revolution of Iran was, was successful because of the revolution of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
It was an echo of his revolution.
Exactly, and there is a famous quote from Imam al-Khomeini alayhi rahmatullah alayhi in this regard. When we see the people of Lebanon, we know that they are inspired by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. People in Yemen, people in Iraq. So Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is a great symbol for justice and for rising against oppression.
He is a representation of what Islam is.
Exactly. Very good, greatly put. So crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we are not getting tired for that. First of all, as I mentioned, it is because of the emotions, and we are absolutely logical for that. Second of all, we have so many narrations in this regard. And third of all, there are philosophies for these narrations which are encouraging the people to remember Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and cry for him. And as you mentioned, rightly mentioned, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is the symbol of keeping Islam alive. So the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt rightly came to this point that the best way to remember the cause of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam
is with raw emotion.
Yeah, through emotions and crying and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And of course, people need to know that besides showing emotions, they need to remember the philosophy of the uprising of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, why Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was martyred for. And I think this is one of the functions of these majalis that we hold every year.
Dear Sheikh, I thank you very much for your time and for your insightful information. I likewise thank our dear listeners for tuning in. This has been your host Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب آل البيت فرض عندنا حب آل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا.
Economic divide.
The report could not be more alarming. The world is getting destroyed through climate change. The largest gas emitters need to comply. But who's listening? Is it even possible to do this in this capitalistic, consumer-driven society? Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide. In this program, we will take a look at climate change and its apocalyptic economic impact, some of the issues that we'll be looking at, the report by the UN body, which issued a code red for humanity. It talked about irreversible and economic-inflicted effects of climate change that need to be taken seriously, irreversible damage, that is. Also, climate change, how it's going to affect the world economy, the economic impact, catastrophic. The cost, roughly $23 trillion by the year 2050. Obviously, a negative world growth that will happen as a consequence. And finally, we will take a look at a startling piece of news that came out a long time ago, worth looking at again, oil companies' role ExxonMobil, in this case, knowing the climate impacts of 4 decades ago, promoting misinformation. Is that happening today? Spending millions to promote this. Are they still holding out on concealment? Dire warnings about irreversible damage to the climate. Code Red for Humanity. The group that released the report, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body for assessing science related to climate change. The warnings were pretty clear and daunting. Major climate change is inevitable and irreversible. Humans have caused unprecedented and irreversible change to the climate, unequivocally caused by human activities. When it comes to the future temperatures, warming depends on choices made today. Recently, climate activists came out in London and protested against climate change and how no one is taking it seriously, especially parliamentarians. Now take a look at them here. They have tied themselves to a car and a giant pink table erected in the middle of the street. The activists are from a group called the Extinction Rebellion Group, or XR. They want an emergency response from governments. In essence, they want action to be taken against this climate change and a mass move away from polluting industries to avert the worst-case scenarios.
I'm doing this because I care about the climate emergency. I care about all living things on this earth, and I am doing something about it.
Joining us is Bill Moyer. He's a climate change activist. He's also the author of Solutionary Rail. That's a book on a people-powered campaign to electrify America's railroads and to open corridors to a clean energy future. All right, Bill, welcome. Taking a look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that came out, the first since 2013, found that human activity is changing the Earth's climate in unprecedented ways, with some of the changes now inevitable and irreversible. Fires in the U.S., Turkey, and Greece, floods in Germany and in Japan, and scorching heat across much of the West. The Asia region also experiencing extreme heat. Please tell us about the report and whether climate change has a direct economic impact that obviously could be devastating.
Well, I'm not an expert on the report. So what I would speak to is that clearly the systems that support life are under threat. You know, in the Pacific Northwest where I live, we normally have very temperate weather, and we had a heat dome. I've never even heard of a heat dome before. So with record temperatures for multiple days, it's clear that the report outlines that there's multiple trillions of dollars worth of damage that will come from the devastation of the impacts of climate change.
Okay, Bill Moyer there. Thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it. Indeed, that is something that perhaps many are feeling. All right. The points that he makes there are what we are witnessing more and more of recently, including, obviously, some of the images that have come across your TV screens, like the wildfires that I mentioned in Turkey and in Greece and, of course, the U.S., especially in the West. Or how about the floods in Germany? I mean, need I go on? There's practically no place on Earth that has not experienced severe weather fluctuations.
Climate change is real, and the heat wave affected this. We didn't see any rain to stop this fire. If it rained right now, it would be bad for us.
It is indisputable that human activities are causing climate change and making extreme weather events more frequent and severe.
Atmosphere has been exposed to doping, which means that we have begun observing climate extremes more often than before.
So imagine that the atmosphere has a blanket around it, and what we're doing is we're pumping more and more heat into that blanket. And that is, of course, impacting weather patterns.
The alarm clock has gone off many times. This is probably the last report that will be written before we go through and beyond 1.5 degrees C, unless we act now.
Heat wave in Canada, fires in California, floods in Germany, floods in China, droughts in central Brazil, make it very, very clear that climate extremes is having a very heavy toll in the socioeconomic system.
Welcome to our InfoNews section. Stories new and old make it in this part of the program. Now, our first story is a warning that was issued by China, something that obviously you need to heed to if it's coming from China. This entry title, Protect Your Wallets, is how it was titled, and it said, stay away from cryptocurrencies. Now, why is the People's Bank of China actually issuing that warning? Well, what it's doing is that it's reminding everyone that Bitcoin and other virtual currencies are not legal tender and are not confirmed by real value. So it's something you might want to take a look at. Now, in the meantime, we go to Cuba and a crypto story coming out of there, and that is that the Cuban government actually recently recognized virtual currencies like cryptocurrency. It said that it's official. However, it said that it's going to regulate it. Now, the popularity of the digital currency has grown in the tiny island there, partly because of restrictions on remittances from the U.S. It just shows how U.S. economic sanctions backfires, since now the U.S. can't control the Cuban cash. Our next story comes out of the United States. It's titled Democracy for Sale. This was an analysis that was done which tied corporate consolidation to increased lobbying. It stated that monopoly is a threat to democracy. Basically, what it's saying is that mergers, when they occur, such as in big tech or the pharmaceutical industry and the oil and gas sector, has increased corporate control of American democracy. And finally, we go to this piece of news, which is really quite incredible if you want to think about it. SOS, Save the World. Yes, why? Central banks spending $834 million per hour, check that figure out, for 18 months to save the global economy. That's due to the coronavirus. I mean, that's a lot of money if you think about it. I mean, currently there's more than $16 trillion in debt with a negative yield. So that just shows you how badly the world economy is suffering from the coronavirus. Now, that does it for the first half of our program, but stay right where you are. We'll be right back after a quick break.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. For this topic, we figured it's best to really see if there is a solution that can be key in reducing greenhouse gas emissions to result in decreasing climate change. Now, first, let's take a look at the bare facts. According to a report that was published by the Carbon Majors Database, which was back in the year 2017, there really are a small number of fossil fuel companies. Based on this report, it revealed that just 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. So pretty much narrowed down the emitters to 100 companies. However, it revealed that out of that, basically more than half of the global industrial emissions since the year 1988 can be traced to just 25 corporate and state-owned entities. So you can see that that list is narrowed down, again, these being the industrial ones. Some of those companies that it cited, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron, to be among the highest CO2 emitters, again, since the year 1988. Now, fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017. This is what's going to happen. global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Now, what is shocking is that one of these large corporations that we just mentioned here, namely ExxonMobil, knew about climate change. How long ago? Almost 50 years ago. To be exact, it was roughly about 46 years ago. Now, in the year 2015, another big revelation revealed that the oil company actually understood the science before it became a public issue. The worst part about this finding is that it spent millions of dollars to promote this misinformation about the issue. Now, key question is, how did it go about spreading misinformation? The climate deception dossiers. That's how it did it.
The reality of global warming began making front page headlines nearly 30 years ago. In 1995, a secret memo commissioned from a scientist at Mobil Oil and distributed to many of the world's largest fossil fuel companies warned that the reality of human-caused warming cannot be denied.
Yeah, a rather large dossier that was released and lots of facts in there. As we mentioned, spreading climate disinformation is what the intention, one of the main intentions of this dossier was. Funding a supposedly independent scientist, again, independent in quotes, which is what ExxonMobil did. Another thing that they did, owning scientists who are warning about the reality of global warming in their terms and in their way of presentation, laying out a strategy to fabricate uncertainty about climate change, and that's really important, this uncertainty part. And again, repositioning global warming as theory, not as fact, are some of the revelations of this dossier. And again, we are emphasizing how fabricating uncertainty about climate science is what their goal was. Now, what is actually the main purpose? What is their motto? The motto is, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Pretty stark, right? I'm sure you'll agree. Well, this practice of lying and concealment continues to this day. For example, in the year 2019, it was reported that some of these companies, which are concealing their climate-related activities, they've been accused of that in terms of the environmental impact that these companies actually have. In terms of the number of companies, it was roughly about 700 of them. So it's quite a lot, like Amazon, Tesco, ExxonMobil. Here we go again with ExxonMobil, and of course Facebook being some of those included in some of those companies. So 700 companies. Obviously, oversight is the key question here. But they were accused of things that were considered concealment, such as water shortages and deforestation, which is a big deal when it comes to climate change. Now, joining us for this segment is Juan Pablo Osornio. He is the global climate political leader at Greenpeace. And based on the Greenpeace website, he is the international head of delegation to the COP, which once he said politics is polluted. Also, Bill Moyer, climate change activist, rejoins us. All right, let me first turn to you, if I may, Juan Pablo. The key question here is, companies like ExxonMobil knew about climate change 40 years ago or so. Old companies understood the science before it became public, and they spent millions to promote misinformation like ExxonMobil. And then 700 large companies later on worldwide failing to disclose their environmental impact, companies like ExxonMobil again, BP and Chevron. If so, why are they allowed to operate and continue to emit CO2?
Well, first and foremost, because it's not illegal. It's not illegal to stop emitting CO2. And I would put this squarely on governments that are not actually putting in place the regulations that are going to avoid a climate emergency. Building on the IPCC report, one of the things that is very clear as a message, even though they might not say it like that, is that we need dramatic, immediate, and constant greenhouse gas emission reductions. That means no new fossil fuel capacity being built, no new fossil fuel infrastructure anywhere in the world, and looking to phase out all fossil fuel infrastructure by the mid of the century. That is, in 30 years, we shouldn't be using any more fossil fuels.
All right, Bill Moyers, let me bring you in here. That was 50 years ago, what was revealed, and then just a couple years back, again, Fortune 500 companies like ExxonMobil, Facebook, and Amazon concealing their company's efforts on climate change. Is this about how they can get away with it? Because that's what it appears like.
Well, I think they're allowed to operate because they've captured the mechanisms of power, and that's not a new story. So, of course, you know, it angers me deeply. You know, I lead a group called Backbone Campaign, and we've been in many anti-fossil fuel company battles, from trying to stop coal exports in the Pacific Northwest, of the United States, and some accountability. I don't believe that we're there yet. I don't think we have the social movement power to enforce that, but I think that we're moving in a direction of truth and reconciliation, of removing these, of dissolving the rights that are defending these profiteers who are benefiting in the short term.
Okay, Bill Moyer, the climate activist. Now, one thing that's missing are the numbers behind, for example, how much money is being lost due to climate change and due to CO2 emissions, in which the next report takes a close look at that. Climate change is not only a systemic risk that must be addressed now, it is also an economic risk. It could wipe off up to 18% of GDP of the worldwide economy by 2050 if global temperatures rise by 3.2 degrees Celsius. In other words, the world economy could be 10% smaller if the 2050 net zero emissions and Paris Agreement targets on climate change are not met. Under the current trajectory, global GDP could be 11 to 14% less by mid-century than in a world without climate change. The UN Environment Program estimates that the global cost of adapting to these climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. When all is said, climate change could cut the world economy by $23 trillion by the year 2050. Just shows how severe an economic impact global warming has. There is a cost of adapting to rising sea levels. This is one of the reasons for the relocation of whole towns. Shrinking productivity of harvest is another factor. That leads to prices of basic foodstuff to rise. Extreme weather will cause widespread poverty. One of the consequences of high temperatures will be the spread of diseases. Another consequence, fresh water will be in short supply. Did you ever really think about how you spend your money and what things you spend your money on, and how you are through that in one way or another contributing to climate change as a result?
Death is upon us. The death of glaciers and ice sheets plummeting into the sea, the death of great swaths of forests. It's clear to me what's driving this descent into climate chaos: capitalism. Since its inception in the urban landscapes of England, industrial capitalism has been a juggernaut of waste, driving plunder and reckless production of needless commodities.
Okay, so that was the capitalism side of things. Pretty scary, but true. Then comes what's called a zero-waste lifestyle.
This is all of my trash from the past 5 years.
Pretty incredible, isn't it? I mean, obviously very hard to do, but imagine if people actually did just even a quarter of that. Well, one major source of destruction from capitalism, coming from factories of conglomerates, is water. Clothing and fossil fuel firms are the worst offenders when it comes to polluting and wasting water, which came out through a study from CDP, a data analysis nonprofit, which said along with the clothing and fossil fuel sectors, cotton and livestock farming were also culprits.
Companies in the financial sector themselves, companies in the fossil fuel, the apparel and the food sectors represent the greatest impact on freshwater resources worldwide. It's not necessarily new information for many of us that have been working in this sector for some time, but for financial institutions themselves, who, as I said earlier, are not necessarily that well informed on the issues, this is going to provide a breakthrough moment for them to be able to figure out who or which companies in their portfolios offer the greatest chance to deliver that outcome that we're looking for.
Global fast fashion brands are helping drive pollution that has dyed African rivers blue or turned their waters to aqua.